All right, Mr. Robertson and Mr. Chris Rose, ready?
Before we jump into the presentation, I just wanted to publicly acknowledge State Water Board member Ms. Diadamo and the Chair Wolf for helping us tap the brakes on that fee modification associated with the State Board action that was supposed to take place yesterday. I think it's useful for us to take a pause there and have a longer conversation about this, but I want to acknowledge the two for helping that pause occur.
Oh. 10 minutes?
Six.
All right. That was my warped sense of humor. So sorry, Steve. So 60 minutes. And then if we do have a quick clarification from my colleagues, we put a pause. So that way we give you the full amount of time that has been allocated. So thank you.
I'm actually trying to speak with my softer, gentler voice here today. Thank you for the reminder. So good morning. My name is Steve Shimmick, and I am Executive Director of the Otter Project and Monterey Coast Keeper. I am here today with Sean Bothwell on the end. He is Executive Director and newly minted Executive Director of California Coast Keeper Alliance. And Ben Pitterly, to my immediate left, he is Watershed and Marine Program Director of Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. I want to suggest to you that our slides, except for this title slide, will be numbered in the lower right-hand corner if you want to ask questions. But we would encourage you, frankly, in the sake of time, to stop us during a slide and ask a question if you'd like. So I'll begin and kind of do a little bit of framing here. And I'd like to begin by taking a moment to reflect. I started working on agricultural pollution issues in 2004. My daughter, Andrea, was a sophomore in high school. Andrea graduated from college in 2010 with a degree in art history, and her mom and I wondered if she would ever get a job. In 2013, Andrea moved to New York. And by 2014, she was working for the New Yorker magazine. By 2016, Andrea was on the masthead of Condé Nast Traveler and Architectural Digest. In 2017, Andrea quit her job, and her mom and I wondered if she would ever get a job again. Andrea now works for Reddit, is happy, and makes far more money than I do. As for me, I've gotten mostly older. I started all this when I was 52. I'm now 66. I'm heavier than I was. More gray hair. I have arthritis in both my hands now. I wear hearing aids in both ears. I can't recommend to anyone the act of getting older. My point is, change can happen very quickly. Directed, and we're trying to make change happen, especially in 14 years. Some, like my daughter, have had entire careers in 14 years. The water on the Central Coast has changed. It hasn't. Here's the 2010 report on water quality. In general, staff finds poor water quality, biological and physical conditions in many water bodies located in or affected by agricultural areas in the Central Coast region. This is what it looked like in 2009. 2018, this is the 2018 surface water quality conditions report. Overall, water quality data in these areas do not indicate that conditions are improving in terms of achieving water quality objectives or protecting beneficial uses. That's surface water, groundwater, nitrate. Well, I'll only read the last sentence of the first paragraph. The most recent nitrate concentration data indicate ongoing and increasing degradation in many groundwater basins, predominantly in agricultural areas. Here's what it looks like. This is a corresponding slide to the first one that I showed, and this was taken just a little bit more than a week ago. I did not run around crazy trying to get these pictures. These are all within a half an hour of my house. You know, some people have a vision of Monterey and Pebble Beach. That's not my Monterey County. This is my Monterey County. Another view of the same ditch looking downstream. This is Alice L. Slough. This is the Blanco Drain. Not to my comment at this moment, but I want you to pay attention to those pipes sticking out. Those are tile drains. I'll be talking about those later on. There are a number of issues you should consider before we even get to the questions of that were posed today. One question is waiver or general WDR. Waivers have more explicit conditions within Port of Cologne. But that said, we believe the same conditions apply to WDRs. Waivers must be reconsidered every 5 years. WDRs do not. But waivers have very little case law. WDRs have a lot of case law to support a strong and aggressive position. We believe a 5-year review, while painful, is helpful. Hopefully it becomes quicker and easier as we see success. Another reason for having a waiver is that the state's non-point source pollution policy is actually a requirement of the Federal Clean Water Act. And waivers are more akin to the Federal Clean Water Act and NPDES permits. Next, there's the non-point source policy itself. We feel non-point source policy has been treated in the past as guidance, and that's what led to our lawsuit. We didn't feel it was guidance at all. As you know, with the exception of a few minor cutouts, the appellate court held that non-point source policy is law, not a casual consideration. We feel non-point source policy is often misstated and misunderstood. Some say non-point source policy encourages management practice instead of compliance with water quality requirements. We totally disagree. Quote from the policy, management practice implementation, however, may not be substituted for actual compliance with water quality requirements, end quote. Also, we see non-point source policy as solidly pointing you towards source control, even numeric standards, and ultimately meeting water quality standards for beneficial uses. Most important are the key elements within the non-point source policy. You don't really need to read this, but I'll summarize it by saying that, first of all, these elements require rigor. It's tough to comply with these elements, but you must do it. So please pay attention. Element 2 says that management practices must be tied to verified improvements in water quality. Element 3 requires you to spell out a specific time schedule and quantifiable milestones. Element 4 requires a feedback mechanism such as monitoring that all parties, the public is specifically called out, can verify that the program is succeeding. Before I pass this off to Sean, I want to point out that our presentations are independent of one another. We did not create a unified point of view, and we didn't do that deliberately. At this stage, we thought it was more important for you to hear a variety of ideas, viewpoints. The scary thing is I have no idea what they're going to say, and they have no idea what I'm going to say. So I'll pass this on to Sean.
Thank Great. Thanks, Steve. And good morning, Chair and board members. Again, my name is Sean Bothwell. I'm the executive director of California Coastkeeper Alliance. We represent California waterkeepers throughout California on a statewide level. California waterkeepers such as Monterey Coastkeeper and Santa Barbara Channel Keeper here. We work primarily.
Speaking a little more slowly.
Oh, slower?
I
thought it was quieter. We work mostly at the State Water Board. But agricultural issues, while they used to be very regional, they've been more and more being elevated to the statewide level as orders get appealed up to the State Water Board. And so we thought it was important, given the various agricultural orders throughout the state, for us to start an agricultural program to better represent our California waterkeepers. And so one thing we did was to create a set of agricultural principles to help us help guide us in our advocacy as we move forward. I will say that not every one of the principles touches exactly on irrigated ag, and so for those, I'm going to skim past those pretty quickly so we can focus in on what you guys want to hear. Principle one, individual growers are held really accountable for enforceable standards, milestones, timelines. This is what Steve spoke about with really the non-point source policy. The Water Board's current reliance on management practices in lieu of enforceable standards, we believe, is illegal under the Port of Cologne Act and the state's non-point source policy. Without performance standards linked to actual objectives, existing requirements like the nutrient management ratios don't really enable us to understand how water quality will be impacted by those practices or whether those practices are effective for meeting those standards. Further still, relying on those best management practices has proven insufficient to date for ensuring that we're meeting those water quality standards. So these are some of the recommendations we came up with when it comes to having enforceable standards for the non-point source policy, to meet the non-point source policy.
I'm sorry. I suffer from speaking too quickly, and we have people translating this.
Okay.
So I know it's difficult, but if you could just concentrate on speaking slowly.
Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And a little more clearly. I mean, if you could enunciate, it would help too.
Okay. Yeah, sorry.
don't worry. Sometimes they tell me, Jean-Pierre, what about that accent you have? So
yeah.
They're not picking on you. They're doing that to me too.
State and regional water boards, one of our recommendations, should, independent of third-party coalitions, develop nutrient loads, whether it's the AR ratios or loads based on acreage, really should be based on the best available science. But those ratios or those requirements need to be enforceable. They don't need to be just guidelines, but actually be enforceable standards. The Regional Water Board should also determine the shortest time possible for meeting standards and setting enforceable interim milestones so that we're achieving water quality objectives, and those should be set by the regional boards, not by third-party coalitions. Water boards also need to comply with the anti-degradation policy by making findings when agricultural activities may produce waste that will discharge into existing high-quality waters, identify degradation of waters through appropriate monitoring, and provide adequate means of ensuring best practical treatment control standards would be implemented when high-quality waters is degraded by existing agricultural activities. And then finally, and I'll circle back to this at the end, but we need to be able to translate narrative nutrient standards into numeric standards that are sufficient to meet the beneficial uses of that water body. Principle two, and this gets to some of the non-point source. Principle four, having an effective feedback mechanism so that we know when we're being successful. We need to have surface water monitoring that gets back to individual compliance and holds each grower accountable. And the way we recommend doing it, we understand that individual monitoring for everyone across the board is probably unreasonable. And if we are to go with this representative approach, the representative monitoring needs to be robust enough so that we are properly detecting exceedances and not missing them. And then once an exceedance is detected in one of those representative sites, it should be the requirement of the regional board to go further upstream into sub-watersheds and detect exactly where that exceedance is coming from. And so once there's that second hit in that upper watershed, we would ask at that point that everyone, all the growers that are discharging into that sub-watershed that have now had two exceedances, be required to do individual monitoring so we can identify who is responsible ultimately for those causing, contributing to exceedances of the water quality standard. And then lastly, for areas, I should probably should have actually skipped one. Lastly, for areas where growers are discharging into impaired waterways, waterways that are already impaired for certain benchmarks, we would ask that those growers be required to do individual monitoring from the outset because the waterway is impaired, and simply to show whether you are causing or contributing to that exceedance. And if you're not, then you don't have to continually doing that individual monitoring. But we think for impaired waterways, there should be another heightened level of monitoring requirements. Third-party coalitions, you know, I know there's a debate throughout the state, actually, of whether we think third-party coalitions are the right way to go or not. I think there are certainly some benefits to third-party coalitions. You know, education, helping with efficiencies, cost sharing, being consistent throughout. We think those are important principles that a coalition can help provide. But what we're concerned about and what we are seeing in the Central Valley is third-party coalitions being used to hide the ball, essentially, to manipulate data, to make it look like performance is better than it is. And then, as we've seen in the East San Joaquin, having anonymous data and aggregating that data by the coalitions. And so we certainly think there could be a positive role for them. But what we don't want to see is the regional boards giving their authority to those coalitions to do their regulatory job. This is one of the questions at the beginning, question three, about how do we improve pesticide and pesticide toxicity. And Steve might be getting to this later, but one of the concerns we have is the monitoring protocols for determining toxicity aren't on par with the pesticides that are actually being used. We're using outdated monitoring protocols when growers have moved on to newer and badder pesticides that aren't being detected by the current monitoring protocols. And so all we ask is that as pesticides shift, we shift those monitoring protocols so we can detect those exceedances. I'm not going to run through all these, but we also provide a list of different best management practices that we think could be used, not just for the monitoring, but actually to control pesticide use so it doesn't end up in our waterways. Riparian setbacks. So we've seen throughout the state riparian encroachment where growers, you know, move right up to the embankments, essentially, and that causes quite a few different impacts to the waterway. You know, sediment discharges, the loss of just riparian habitat makes the temperature warmer. It doesn't create that riparian buffer to stop things like sediment and nutrients and pesticides from running off into the waterway. So we really think it's important that the state and the regional boards set conditions for setbacks. It should be based on the best available science, but for certain areas, there should be some just certain basic standards that we provide in our ag orders. Again, this one's not really completely on point with irrigated ag, and so I'm going to skip over it quickly. But I just want to take a moment to say that, you know, at one point, the state board was going to do a grazing program. They punted it back to the regional boards. And to date, I haven't seen a lot of updating those grazing best practices and management measures. And I think this one's fairly simple of just, you know, keeping livestock outside of the waterway. Don't have them in the waterway. And to the point here with, the growers, if the growers are discharging into an impaired waterway and they're doing their job, you know, they're doing their best practices to do what they need to do, and yet we still have livestock causing sediment and bacteria concerns, you know, I think we want all actors to be acting in an appropriate manner. Again, this is another one that I'll skip over quickly. It's more about water rights, but only to say that water quality can largely be impacted by the amount of water that's actually in the surface flows. If you have more flows in the river, then there's help with dilution. The load isn't as extreme, and it doesn't impair the waterway to quite the extent. So just getting a handle on the amount of water we're using, I think, is important for both water quality and water rights issues throughout the state. Cover crop. So this is another just sediment management practice. Just thinking back to the East San Joaquin order and some of the other practices, there's a lot of punting, I would say, of they need to do a sediment management plan, but there's not really best practices or guidelines on what the regional board or the state board is expecting for folks to help with cover crop. I think cover crop's important for sediment, keeping sediment where it is, keeping pesticides where they are, so they're not into the waterway. And so we provide numerous recommendations. I think the key one, though, is just to maximize the crop residue and cover crop for times when fields lay fallow. And I realize, we chose October through May. That might not be applicable throughout the state. There might be crops at different times. But if the field is fallow, we would recommend cover crop to help with sediment and toxicity issues. This is obviously a really important issue that probably should have been bumped up to the top of the principles list. And I know that the Environmental Justice Panel is obviously going to focus on this, and so I'm not I'll let them get into detail about the impacts. I think we all know what California is facing when it comes to the human right to water. Just a few recommendations, and again, I defer to the environmental justice groups, but for us, the three big recommendations that we had was, again, having an enforceable nutrient loading standards. Even when we have those standards in place, there's still folks out there that don't have the drinking water now, and so providing them that near-term emergency replacement water is critical. And then setting a fertilizer fee, we think those that are contributing to the problem need to help pay to offset and provide that replacement water. Again, this is out of irrigated lands discussion, but it's similar to the grazing and livestock issue that we're finding a lot of non-regulated, actually non-dairy CAFOs throughout the state. And we're doing a lot of research now. We hope to actually provide it to the State Water Board at the end of this year, just how many non-regulated, non-dairy CAFOs there are in California. And those are leading to sediment bacteria issues, nutrient issues in the waterway, waterways that, the growers are also discharging into impaired, and if everyone can do their part, it helps go a long way. And then lastly...
Can you repeat that last part? I couldn't understand.
Just the very last point?
The last comment you made, the last point.
Only that...
Something about impaired waterway? I'm not sure what you said.
So there's certain... there's waterways that are impaired for, nutrients, bacteria, sediment. Well, for CAFOs, let's just go with bacteria and nutrients that are causing that waterway to be impaired. And I realize that, when you do whatever it might be, a TMDL or whatever program you put in place, identify those sources that are causing or contributing to that impairment. But my point was that the non-dairy CAFOs are going unregulated. And so there might be additional burdens put on growers or put on the regulated CAFOs that might be unfair or inequitable because some of these folks are just being completely unregulated. And they are causing very large impacts to the waterway. Finally, Principle 11. We've seen that these orders have been focused primarily or almost exclusively on the human beneficial uses, domestic, municipal, agricultural. But we've really seen that there's been a shying away from protecting the beneficial uses of fish and wildlife and other resources. And this gets back to one of my first points of being able to translate nutrient narrative standard into some type of numeric standard for surface water so that we're not just protecting human uses but also protecting the aquatic and wildlife uses as well. I'll just skip that part. So with that, I will give it to Ben to take over.
Good morning. I'm Ben Pitterly. I'm with Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. I started working on, I've been following the development of the Central Coast Ag Waiver for about 10 years now, I think. I started working on this in 2008. So on the slide here, this is a subset of the questions that staff posed to stakeholders. The top one has to do with demonstrating improvements to groundwater, but the bottom three all have to do with how growers and the regional board can demonstrate quantifiable progress. So over the last 10 years, I've personally participated in and followed this ongoing discussion about how to quantify or demonstrate progress. And most of the various iterations of the waiver programs in that time that I'm familiar with have all utilized various proxies for actual water quality data to try to demonstrate improvements. So things like checklists, farm plans, educational requirements, BMP surveys, enrollment. All of these types of tools have been utilized, and yet here we are in 2018, and we're still struggling to get a handle on many of our water quality problems associated with agriculture, and we're engaged in pretty much the exact same discussion about how to demonstrate progress or compliance. And at the end of the day, I'm not personally sure how exactly one can demonstrate quantifiable progress to achievement of a water quality objective without actual water quality data. So an individual grower and the regional board can be assured that the grower is making progress when the water coming out the back end of a BMP is improving in quality. At some level, individual farm BMP verification monitoring seems essential to ensuring that progress will occur and result in eventual attainment of objectives. But before I share an example of how one region approaches individual monitoring, I want to just for a moment push back a little bit on the questions that are being asked of us, because I don't believe it shouldn't be merely a question of what we can do to show how we are improving, but what can we do to ensure that compliance is actually achieved and water quality objectives are actually met. So the LA Ag Waiver, the LA Regional Board's Ag Waiver is not a perfect waiver. I don't want to give that impression. In some ways, it falls short, especially when it comes to groundwater, in my opinion. And I'm not recommending that this region model itself solely on its approach, but there are a few elements of the LA Ag Waiver that I think are worth highlighting. So LA recognized that the goal is not to work indefinitely towards improvement. The goal is to actually achieve water quality objectives, and it adopted certain measures in an attempt to provide real assurances that compliance will occur. First and foremost, the LA waiver contains specific time schedules to achieve water quality requirements. Second, that schedule triggers individual discharge monitoring for all growers upstream of a contaminated site if water quality objectives are not met. And then finally, the timeline triggers conversion of benchmarks or targets to enforceable effluent limitations at the point of discharge. So through these measures, LA created a program that has an enforceable endpoint where it has the tools to enforce with discretion for a failure to achieve water quality standards. And how often will enforcement actually occur? Probably not a lot, in my opinion. I think the preferable course will probably usually be to continue working with a grower in good faith to improve BMPs, but the tool is finally there and it's available for the LA staff and its board to use if a particular discharger or if a particular discharge seems egregious and enforcement is warranted. And that tool is tied directly to actual improvement in water quality, not to implementation of BMPs or some type of proxy reporting requirement.
Ben, before you move on to the next slide, could you, on that slide at the bottom, can you give us some examples of what kinds of benchmarks appear in the LA order? I'm looking at the very bottom part of your slide.
Sure. If you'd like me to take a moment, I could look through some notes and
do you have any
identify
your...
that? I mean, they point to basin plan water quality objectives and other types of commonly used standards for nutrients.
So do they take water quality objectives, which are enforceable on their own, and convert them initially into just benchmarks?
I could give you specific numbers if you'd like me to take time to look at some of the, but I can't off the top of my head tell you how closely at the point of, I think you're getting at, are they enforcing in-stream water quality objectives at the point of discharge? And I'd have to look more closely at the...
Well, I'm looking at what were they using as benchmarks? So it may, at some other time, maybe you could provide that to us if it's not on the top of your memory.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a quick clarification. I'm confused. You started talking about how achieving groundwater, progress towards groundwater quality couldn't really be done without some direct measurements as opposed to proxies. And is this, and then you move to this as an example, is this surface water?
I understand the question there, and if I'll get to that a little bit later. I understand with groundwater quality, some of the direct measurements are a little bit more
okay, so the LA, but the LA waiver you're talking about is surface water.
It's surface water and groundwater, and the benchmarks that are referred to in this slide apply to tailwater, surface water discharges that would reach a stream.
Okay, so yeah, because boy, if we have a way for directly measuring, the huge problem for us is the time lag with groundwater, and if there's a way out there, we'd like to hear it.
So this slide shows the timelines for compliance that were adopted by the LA waiver, and you can see that they chose to align their compliance with timelines identified in existing TMDLs. And in a way, this makes a lot of sense, right? Because TMDLs are essentially planning documents, and achievement of TMDL targets is largely supposed to occur through implementation of permits and other orders such as the ag waiver. But two criticisms that I've heard offered by Central Coast staff and others regarding this approach is that, one, LA's timelines are all far away and therefore not really indicative that individual verification monitoring will ever occur. And this point I'll just note is simply untrue. As you can see, the TMDL deadlines adopted by the LA waiver are forthcoming. They're typically in the range of 3 to 5 years away from this point. And at that point in time, individual monitoring must occur at the edge of field where surface water, tailwater discharges are occurring, and effluent limitations apply at the point of discharge. And that's a big motivator for growers in that region. Second, I've heard that LA is different from the Central Coast and that the Central Coast does not have TMDLs covering a significant number of its impaired water bodies. And on this point, yes, while most of Ventura County's impaired water bodies are covered by an applicable TMDL, and the same might not be quite true for the Central Coast, the Central Coast region does have many applicable TMDLs that apply to agricultural contamination. There's actually a lot of them. And just to give you an idea, there are either existing TMDLs or several under development and that apply to agricultural pollutants currently for Elkhorn Slough and Bennett Slough, Salinas River Watershed, San Ynez River Basin, Choro Creek, Los Barros Creek, Los Osos and Warden Creek, the Pajaro River Watershed, Salinas River Watershed, Lower Salinas, the Santa Maria River Watershed, and several for contaminated streams in my area, including for Bell Creek, Glen Annie Canyon, Tecolotito, San Antonio Creek, Los Caneros Creek, Arroyo Paradon, and most recently Franklin Creek, which is the watershed where I actually live. I live on a farm in the Franklin Creek watershed. The watershed's filled with all kinds of commercial agriculture. There are orchards, row crops, nurseries, and now cannabis as well. The Franklin Creek TMDL has an actual timeline to achieve water quality standards, both for drinking water standards and aquatic life. But it's currently deficient because it identifies the ag waiver solely as the method of implementation, and the ag waiver currently fails to have compliance mechanisms to enforce the TMDL timeline. It fails to have monitoring mechanisms that actually apply to growers in the watershed to ensure progress towards compliance. And then maybe most important of all, it fails to adequately address the actual issue causing contamination in Franklin Creek, which is loading of shallow groundwater, very shallow groundwater. And just to highlight the problem from the ground level with one example, this is a photo of a foot drain along a creek leading to the Carpinteria salt marsh. It's a concrete light channel in the lower section, and all of the flow in summer months, just like for Franklin Creek and other creeks in the area, all the flow comes from springs or shallow groundwater that seeps through stream banks through drains like this one. Just to give you an idea of what you're looking at, there isn't a pipe behind this hole that leads to a tailwater discharge. It's just soil behind that wall. And the soil is being saturated by irrigation by adjacent farms or by disposal of your agricultural wastewater to the soil. So we walked up this particular channel a few years back in the summertime. No rainfall had occurred for many months. And when we walked upstream, this drain was not flowing, nor were the four or five next to it. We went about a quarter mile, and we turned around, and within just about 30 minutes, this drain and the others around it started gushing water. So what that tells me is that this isn't chronically saturated soil from a high water table. This is a discharge linked to an irrigation event or a waste disposal event that within a window of minutes or maybe hours worked its way to the stream. And the interesting thing about this specific discharge, as you can see, is that when we sampled it, you can see it has this nice pink color. And as it turns out, many of the surrounding nurseries actually apply a dye to their irrigation water. Carpinteria is known for its cut flower industry, and dyes are used often to enhance coloring of the flowers. And so here, just like sometimes a sewer district or homeowners can use a dye to detect leaks or identify sources of pollution, this is essentially a tracer test that links this specific discharge to agricultural practices. And the sample read off the charts. For nitrate, by the way, something like 40, 50 milligrams per liter, and it's directly associated with application of agricultural water to the ground. The existing waiver doesn't come close to preventing this or even minimizing this form of pollution, and shallow groundwater contamination is the number one source of nitrogen impairment for every nitrogen-contaminated stream in my area, really for every one of them. You can over-apply nitrogen without having a runoff event, and you can contribute to surface water impairments, without ever having a runoff event. So my last slide, what does the next waiver need to contain to get to a point where it can demonstrate improvements to water quality? It needs to contain measures that reduce or mitigate for shallow groundwater contamination. So it needs to have enforceable nitrogen application limits, for one. Growers are applying way too much fertilizer. We know this, and it needs to be addressed in a way that's actually enforceable. And also vegetated riparian buffers, which we know improve water quality, should be required so that excess nutrients have a chance of being filtered through the root zone before seeping into streams and rivers. So these are two very solid practices, both source control and treatment oriented, along with enforceable timelines for compliance and verification monitoring that we believe should be a strong focus of this next waiver. Thank you.
Could we get a time check?
26 minutes.
Oh, we're good.
Yeah, you're doing good.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate that we're doing good. So now I'm going to get to some really specific things and address, I hope, in finer detail exactly what the questions are and what we could do, in my opinion. These may be, in many cases, different than what my friends have said, but along the same lines. First of all, let's talk about controlling nitrogen. I think one of the very first things that we can look at is that there are some recommendations out there. This is U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they came up with three practices that they actually said were key practices. And this was actually a paper. It's cited up at the top there. And it's basically talking about what should guide our policy. And so here you go. They're saying that the three key practices are rate, apply no more nitrogen than 40%. So crop need plus 40%. More than that removed by the crop at harvest. I won't read that. Timing. They say timing is incredibly critical. Don't apply fertilizer in the fall when there's not a crop in the ground. And believe it or not, there are growers that do that. They believe, oh, there has to be some there. And then method. They say that injecting or incorporating nitrogen rather than broadcasting on the surface and not incorporating it is a best practice. One of the interesting things that they say is a recommendation could be an area where areas leaching to groundwater source, the first two are most important. the rate and the timing. Then there's then this goes on, and here's kind of the issue. If you just look at new, think about even if the exact proper amount of nitrogen is added. In other words, if you spoon feed that crop, there is still going to be some nitrogen that gets away. It's just inevitable. It's just like no septic system is perfect. There's no system that's perfect. So even if you spoon feed a crop, you're going to need treatment. And that's where your best management practices come in. And so think of it hand in hand. Both, they have to apply the right amount, and then no matter what, there has to be some safeguards at the end for treatment because you will need it. We heard yesterday that a couple of people said, well, there is no runoff from their farms. There is always runoff from farms. That runoff may come from percolation. That runoff may be from tailwater. That runoff may be from stormwater. There is runoff from everything. I found this USDA statement amazing. It says, based on a wide range of studies, Meyer et al. 2005 estimates that buffers can remove 74% of the nitrogen passing through the buffer root zone. First, there's the number, 74%. That's huge. Second, there's the aha moment when you read through the root zone. They are not talking about filtering water as it moves through the grass. They're talking about infiltrating the water into the shallow root zone of the riparian area itself, which means that if you're on steep slopes, you're going to need a broader buffer. If you're on no slopes, you're going to need maybe only a 25 or 30-foot buffer. And then there's the second aha moment, which is, however, in many areas of the country where the drains are used to control the water, tile drains are used, subsurface flows pass beneath that riparian corridor and go directly out into the creek. That was, maybe I'm just dense, but that was an aha moment to me. In other words, if you have a tile drain system, your riparian buffers may really not be doing you any good, okay? So I guess what I'm saying is this points to the fact that there's two courses. You've had a Y in the road. Systems that are tile drained and systems that are not. And that's going to be reflected in my next set of slides. So first of all, let's consider everything, both tile drained and not tile drained. I believe that there should be both a numeric application standard and a load limit. But I've lost my place, so give me a second. So as you develop that numeric standard for application, I feel that there's kind of two ways that you can go. You can think of the USDA standard, which we've already gone through, apply no more than 40% above the crop need, or, and this is not something that I made up. This was actually came from an advisor. That suggestion was, and this is more liberal, apply no more than 150% of the nitrogen requirement as fertilizer amendment. I would invite questions on this because what you will note is that this person is saying don't include the water, the amount of nitrogen in the water. So I hope that there's a question. In addition to the application limit, we believe that each area or subwatershed should have a load prescription, a total weight of nitrogen that can be applied per unit area. We believe those two things work hand in hand. They are complementary. It's not, oh, this is redundant. Those two things are complementary. Um, those were the numeric limitations, and now the best management practices, and this is the following the why now. This is for non-channelized flows. Basically, what we're saying is that there should be a 50-foot minimum buffer. Crops planted on any slope must install management practices to slow and infiltrate that water. And then this one is important, especially around here where we have strawberries. Crops planted on any slope using impermeable materials must install detention ponds to capture and infiltrate any excess irrigation water or stormwater that is coming down. And you can use your LID sizing requirements to determine the size of that detention pond. And finally, there's a list of additional management practices, cover cropping, wetlands, two-stage ditches, bioreactors, saturated buffers, and these all work really well. Then you've got your channelized flow. Some of this is the same, but here we put limitations at the end of the pipe. People say, oh, no, you can't look at the end of the pipe. Return flows from agriculture are exempt. That's from the Clean Water Act, not from Porter Cologne. And what I'm saying is, so now you have a pipe that, for the most part, represents discharge from that field. Why aren't we utilizing that pipe and monitoring at the end of the literal pipe? So no drains should discharge water into a water of the state in excess of 10 milligrams per liter after 5 years and no more than 2 milligrams per liter after two. Channelized flows should be routinely monitored and reporting using a field test kit. It doesn't have to go to a lab. Be a field test kit. Where channelized flows show an exceedance, the exceedance shall be reduced by 50% within three years and eliminated by five. Where channelized flows show persistent exceedance due to high nitrogen source water, which can be identified. We heard some about this yesterday. I don't want to be penalized for using my high nitrogen source water. What they need to do, and you have the perfect situation here with these pipes, is that they simply need to show a decrease. In other words, that they're essentially doing pump and treat. There is an irrigation level of nitrogen, and then there is an end of pipe level of nitrogen. They should be different, and the end of the pipe should actually be lower. The source as well as the discharge water must be monitored in that situation and reported, again, using a field test kit. Recommended practices, some of them are the same, and one of the things that I'll note is some of these practices, and if there's a question, I'd be happy to answer, some of these practices work very well with tile-drained systems, especially the two-stage ditches and the bioreactors. Now let's get to toxicity. It's actually kind of the same. Yes. I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson.
Quick question. What's a two-stage ditch?
Ditch is, okay, think of a two-stage ditch is think of a ditch that has a bench on it. And so the tile drain discharges onto that bench, and then that bench is vegetated with specific vegetation and channelized slightly so that you have retention time. And so it ends up getting a vegetated treatment before it gets into the bottom of the ditch. You're welcome. So much of this is the same. No channelized flow. It's the same as the nitrogen requirements. Channelized flow from field. Same general framework. What we're saying is no drain should discharge water into water of the state in excess of one toxic unit. So that's a pesticide measurement where you can use multiple pesticides to come up to one killing unit, right? A sample of channelized flows should be routinely monitored quarterly for 2 years and every other year thereafter, where channelized flows show exceedance. That exceedance must be reduced by 50% within 2 years here and entirely eliminated by three. Now, how do you monitor all this? And this is probably the most, I'll call it, radical piece of my presentation. So we know that there's the old paradigm. We have these 50 monitoring sites, and there's problems with them. They're far away from any source, but there's lots of problems. And it's not showing us what we need to comply with the non-source policy. You're just not going to get to compliance of the non-point source policy using the monitoring structure that you have. You won't get there. So we hired a consultant. The consultant that we hired is probably the most well-respected consultant in the West. It's Dr. Revital Kasnelson. She teaches at UC Berkeley, and she advises the state board and various regional boards. She is co-designer of the surface water monitoring program for the state of California, she's respected. She's where it's at. What's interesting is that I at first didn't like her proposal at all. I hated it. And she started out by saying, okay, what's the purpose of monitoring? And she said, okay, the purpose of monitoring is to see if we're getting there and complying with policy. And the second purpose that she came up with is she believes that growers need to be paying attention. She believes that in pesticide, and she believes that in nitrates. What we're doing is we're going out and doing the monitoring for all these growers. Do the growers know their numbers? So... what, and then she says we should have goals. What are the goals that follow from this purpose? And the goals are that we have compliance. We need to have source identification in real time. And we need to have management practice effectiveness evaluation, because that's called for in non-point source policy. And we need to be able to tell what the long-term trend is. Are we getting there? Then after that, and there's 49 slides in this pack, we're on 46, so we're getting there. Component one, so she says basically what you have to have is you have to have specific studies for each of these questions. And she came up with these specific studies. And this sounds expensive. It's less money, by far, I believe, than what you're spending now. Component one, long-term monitoring. She says, give me three or four sites. I don't need 50. Give me three or four well-chosen sites and let me monitor those, and those will be our sites which will indicate our long-term trends. Two, commodity-based stations. She's saying, you know, commodities use specific management practices. And so let's go to the commodities and measure the effectiveness of the management practices. And she says that way we'll be able to measure, in other words, meet non-point source pollution policy and be able to evaluate the effectiveness of these different practices. Component three is where it gets rather bizarre. Component four. This is what I hated. She says we should not be doing the monitoring, the growers should be. And it shouldn't be, not every sample, she says, use the appropriate tool to monitor. Not every sample has to go to the lab. She says, especially for things like nitrate, she says, use test strips. There are these ampules that are really good, and they are more accurate than a test strip, and they are as easy as a test strip. And she says, use those. So it's a field kit. And she says, the growers should be routinely monitoring and reporting via a smartphone app. Think of the volume, and this will be the hard part, think of the volume of information that you're going to get. You're also going to be able to detect if someone is lying, because you're going to have all these growers giving you data, and we're going to be trusting them. But somebody that is making up the data is going to stick out, because you're going to have all their neighbors reporting data. So you're going to have collusion or something to do it. I hope you ask me about this. This is incredible. This was mind-altering for me. It was a huge step, but a huge volume of data coming in. And the interesting thing about this is what happens when the growers are doing this on a routine basis, and when I say routine, twice a week, and a couple of different sites, you know, their tailwater maybe if they have it, their pond if they have it, but standardize the sites. Then they do this. They are going to start relating their test daily or weekly test results to the practices on their farm. And they're going to say, oh, it went way up, and this is where I'm getting my exceedance. It's when I do this. This is cool. This is beautiful. Then the quick response track back. Think Ghostbusters. What this is going to be is basically a team, which when the data coming off the farm shows a spike, this team can then go out and within hours or a couple days, because we're getting these results in twice a week, can then go in and track back up that watershed and identify the source. Finally, there's special studies. But here's what I'm suggesting is that this is done by the Regional Water Quality Control Board staff. This may relate to your fee structure. If you are doing the monitoring for them, can you collect the fees for monitoring? I think you should. I think that this is what you do. This is my almost my last slide. How do you protect a riparian area? It's relatively easy, and it's actually been, people have been doing this for a couple of decades now. It's basically you overfly an area, and you create a high-resolution map using multispectral analysis and LIDAR. That map gives you, can then go, literally go into a computer program, and the computer program identifies things as agricultural lands, riparian, water, municipal, urban. It create, and it's to the square meter, or 10 square meters. It's incredibly accurate. What's cool is it's geo-based, so what happens is you can then compare maps. You've overfly it again, maybe in 2 years. It spits out a map. The computer then, in seconds, essentially says, here's where you lost riparian habitat. It was at Fred's place. And you can go talk to Fred. We were promised this in some ways, indirectly. When the photo monitoring was removed, staff said we would replace it with something more effective. Hasn't happened yet. This is what you should do. This is what you should do. This will work. There are municipalities, AMBAG, is doing this right now, not right now, but they overfly about every couple years, and they take partners in. Finally, I want to leave you with a quote. This is my last thought. This is a poignant quote from a past regional board executive staff member. Quote, urgency. How urgent is this problem? I don't know how it could be more urgent. I mentioned the domestic wells, the threat to domestic wells, and the fact we know that people in our region, in agricultural areas, are drinking from domestic wells, that the water is not being treated, that they are drinking polluted water today. When they woke up this morning, they were drinking polluted water. And at the end of the day, when we're all done talking, they'll go home and they're going to be drinking polluted water. And it's our, and he meant the board, it's our responsibility. There is no other agency. It's us. That statement comes from Michael Thomas in 2011 during the development of 2.0. Before 2.0 was finalized, so you were operating under 1.0. We are now 7 years past that, and I think urgency and the scope of the problem begs for bold action, not for half measures, not for tiptoeing, not for a measured approach. People are drinking polluted water in your region. Now, I was cautioned to not be too strident, but I would say it's not just you. I would say it's all of us. We need to get it done this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And just as for the order of the record, our board member, Mayor Bruce Delgado, was present at 11 o'clock. Thank you. Welcome. So at this time, questions from my colleagues. Start on my right with Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Wolf. I'm just kind of reviewing my notes here to see how many of these I really want to ask. Okay, let me see if I can just whip through these. Steve, I believe it was you who mentioned that you thought that monitoring ought to move upstream early before you rolled out your big time monitoring proposal. That you thought that monitoring ought to move upstream to identify the source. And you guys tell me if this came from one of the other ones of you rather than Steve. And that if monitoring showed that a grower was not discharging in excess of standards, that the grower should be able to discontinue monitoring, something like that. And who was that coming from? Okay. What about the problem in this region? There's a lot of movement. It's pretty rare that any of the big agricultural operations are operating exclusively on their own land, and it's pretty common that, particularly in strawberries, but you see it in all the row crops, that they're farming one piece of land here for a year or two, or maybe two and a half, and then another piece for a year and a half, and then, I mean, that's just the nature of the business. So how would that work?
I would assume that if the ambient site or the in-stream site still isn't achieving a water quality objective and there's a change in operator or owner, that new operator and owner would once again be subject to the monitoring requirements until LA's program works that way, where they can, if they have two consecutive samples that show that they're complying, they're no longer required to do individual monitoring.
But if there was a change in ownership, the water body starts turning up bad again.
That's right.
But if the water body is already turning up bad, and then they have two good samples, they're exempted from monitoring indefinitely as long as it doesn't change operators.
That's my current understanding of LA's program.
Thank you.
I wouldn't sure.
Next, in terms of the principles that you were running down, how do we incentivize no-till? And I understand that no-till, I'm having trouble seeing how it would work in the commodity row crops.
Yeah, so one thing just off the bat is, I mean, those principles and those recommendations, you know, I'll be honest that some might not fit in a specific regions. You know, my alliance, we were trying to make statewide principles that that could be applied statewide. So there might be certain things, and we can think through more how best to incentivize those things on a, you know, regional water board level. But it was more aimed at some of the other work that's being done throughout the state for healthy soils and incentivizing those things.
All right. Back to Santa Barbara. You were talking about that it was essentially a critique that we've just been utilizing proxies for the groundwater rather than actual water quality measurements. Given the time lag problems, how do we not utilize a proxy in terms of the groundwater stuff?
I take your point. And the examples I gave and the solutions that we recommended for groundwater were, in a manner of speaking, other versions of proxies. When I said the word proxies, I suppose I was focusing on how this region and others have focused on surface water, tailwater discharge compliance. There are, and in some of the staff reports that this board's put together, the most recent one on groundwater, I know that they get into a discussion of groundwater monitoring devices like lysimeters and things like that, tensiometers. So I imagine there may be some creative solutions to groundwater monitoring that give you quantifiable data. Lacking those things, focusing on application limits and riparian buffers seems to me like the best way to result, the best approach that would actually result in improvement.
Okay. And then, Steve, you were talking about use of plastics on slope and specific requirements for impoundments, impoundment ponds where there's use of plastics on slope. One of the very common things we're seeing in this region now, it's been exploding the last 5 years, is hoop houses, which, of course, is it's a different use of plastic than mulch plastic like they use in the berries. But do you have a thought? I see that, frankly, quite a bit where there's no slope.
Right. So I guess, first of all, I actually had the same thought myself. And what I don't know is if they're using a permeable plastic to let rain in when it rains, and that way they can do it or not, or if it's just straight plastic. So assuming that it's an impermeable surface, yes, it's the exact same thing. I don't want to pick on strawberries. My wife will get mad at me. I want to simply say that any practice, whether it be a municipality, urban, rural, agriculture, if they are installing impermeable surfaces on the ground, they must mitigate the increased flow and velocity of their actions.
You're not just picking on strawberries. Now I'm seeing bushberries, blueberries, and I saw some vegetable row crops the other day under hoop houses. Apparently anything grows better under a hoop house.
And the interesting thing about the idea of mitigating this is you've been through this before. You already have the information of how to size that detention pond. You know, they don't have to catch every inch of a 20-inch rainfall. They have to catch a statistical rainfall, and that's what they must impact.
Okay, last question. I'll bite. You were talking about 150% of crop required nitrogen, without counting the nitrogen in the water, as a limit of nitrogen application, somehow combined with an acreage load limit. I'm not quite sure I understand how this would work, particularly in a multi-crop per year setup.
Well, so first of all, the numeric limit on how much they can apply to the crop, the 150. The logic of the it's the same number as not the same number, but the same concept as the USDA recommendation of 140% of what's utilized by the crop. I'm saying 150% of utilized by the crop, and I'm being very liberal by saying, and they don't have to consider the water, which is huge, right? The water can be very significant. And the logic of this crop advisor was, he says, the problem is that the growers are, sometimes they need more nitrogen than what is supplied by the irrigation water in that moment. So in other words, an irrigation, your crop is at that place where it needs a lot of nitrogen. And so they, so even though the water may have quite a bit, they need to add more. Now if you're counting all that water that is in the residual nitrogen that's in there day in and day out, they're probably going to be in exceedance. And so that's what the process was. I don't think that that's good enough, but I do think that that will take us a long way. So I would suggest to you that that is, would not be a final measure. I think that you're going to have to, you know, dial down the amount of nitrogen further than that in the longer run. But in the short run, I think that this will eliminate those people that are applying, you know, 3 times to 8 times that the data shows that they're applying now. And so
the load limit?
Thank you. The load limit, I think, is essentially is critical. In other words, if you have an acre or a township or a sub-watershed, you should be able to only apply the load that you know is needed by those crops and those variety of crops. It's going to change from year to year.
Okay, I still don't understand. I understand 150%. That's easy. I don't get the load limit.
I think that the environmental justice people will be talking more specifically about that, specifically the people with East San Joaquin, Eastern San Joaquin experience, and salt and nutrient management plan experience. But even Harter, in his report, was talking about there's only so much a watershed can absorb, only so much, and here's that number. So there are ways to come up with that number. And they're saying you just can't pour on more fertilizer than that.
So it sounds like the real limiting factor might not be the 150%, but the load limit.
No, these are independent things.
Okay.
So if that was the misconception, these are independent things.
Thank you.
And for Ms. Gray, thank you, Mike. I would like us to not to get too deep in the weeds. You know, I think we're talking still concepts at this stage. Certainly, I don't want to prevent my colleagues, you know, from asking questions, but I know it's easy to kind of inadvertently, you know, do a deep dive. So for the sake of continuing the flow, I'd like to pursue that.
Thank you. I don't have specific questions. I appreciated the discussion related to sub-watershed level, and I very much appreciate the presentation and the time that you've taken today to provide us with this input so that we have a lot of good food for thought. So thank you.
Likewise, thank you for the presentation and for bringing that statewide perspective, which we don't. It's a pleasure to see you here, and so it's important to hear your views on how these issues are being played out in other areas. That helps. And I'll just keep my comment short. It's not a question, really, but just a comment on the proxy data. You know, I think if you, in hindsight, we can always look back and say, wow, you know, we just didn't see it. It was right in front of us. We didn't kind of identify this better, more efficient, better effectiveness in monitoring. But I just have to remind you that you may not have been around in 2012 when the first order with monitoring was actually, you know, defined and initiated in early stages of what monitoring could do and what monitoring data could was reasonable in terms of us initiating the whole program. And then in 2017, you know, refinements are made, and here we are at 2020. I think without proxy data, we would not have sufficient rationale or understanding or motivation to see that some changes are actually showing in proxy data that improvements can be made. And I think in terms of working collaboratively across all stakeholders, showing where changes are occurring, even if it's not definitive, even if it's not as scientifically based as we're technologically capable of producing, I think that proxy data has helped substantially to move the discussion. And so in discussing what's possible, what's reasonable, what's essential, what's urgent, proxy data, I think, has played an important role. And so while I agree with the frustration of not being where we should be, I think looking back over the role of proxy data, I have to say it's been a benefit. I would also suggest that, in my mind, proxy data is also human health and how we look at chronic health issues that occur in most impacted communities. San Gerardo is one of those locations that we have, or communities that we have had the benefit of understanding how they went about demonstrating the true impacts of chronic exposure to high nitrate water. I get your comment, but I don't look back and regret the best ways we could see at that time. And I think that improves over time. And as we move from proxy data to more scientific and more certainty, more valid types of monitoring, all to the good. But it's a process. It is not a black and white situation where we're able to just simply launch something that had not been in place in such a widespread and complicated scene as our ag industry is in the coastal region. So I would just leave it at that. It's not really a question.
Thank you, Dr. Hunter.
Could I just take 60 seconds maybe just to respond? Because I'm not disagreeing with you. I did participate very thoroughly in development of the 2.0, so all the way back to 2008, and I remember my point was rather that this body and many of the people in this room had the exact same discussion then about how do you demonstrate actual improvement in water quality. I'm not suggesting that proxy data isn't useful or that it shouldn't be a part of the next iteration. I'm saying that at the end of the day, relying on only proxy data isn't a substitute for actually having back-end BMP verification monitoring.
All right, thank you. So, Mr. Young?
Thank you. Thank you guys for your presentations. I appreciate them. I don't have any questions for you. I made notes throughout the handout that I have of your PowerPoint slides, and I would just ask staff if they could provide us with all of these digitally. Some of these are kind of hard to read. We've got three slides. We did get them?
Did.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I just focused on these. So
you have them in an email.
Perfect.
Or you're in your email box.
Perfect. Okay. Great. Yes. Can you repeat that? Thank you.
They're picking on you.
I know.
Mayor Delgado?
Thank you. I apologize for the conflict that made me be late today. But I wanted to mention to this panel to get your feedback. some of you were here yesterday, and one of the big elephants in the room, riparian. Should be. So riparian buffers are one of the big elephants in the room. There was a bit of discussion yesterday. Recently we had a field trip, and we were shown how difficult they are to maintain and maintain animal-free, which sort of negates some of the purpose of having riparian buffers. But I wanted to get your take on it in a general way, at a conceptual level. How do we maintain buffers and still comply with buyers' food safety requirements?
Well, I have a couple of ideas on that. One is, well, three ideas specifically. One is riparian buffers may not be essential if you're talking about an area that's tile drained. So there's some areas that you don't need buffers. Two, there are vegetation types that may not attract the certain types of wildlife that are problematic for food safety. I know that out at the Malera wetland, I once asked the research. This is an engineered wetland that was created specifically for study, and I asked the scientist in charge, "What's that?" And it was a vegetation. It was a very tall reed, and he says, "Oh, that's a specific type of reed, and the birds can't fly into it because it just is. I'm sorry, it's just so tall and tends to grow so thick that the birds can't navigate, the water birds can't navigate into the water." I think that there's other solutions like that. I also would point out that while it is true that that the growers, I'm hoping that we're past the day when buffer strips need to be scorched earth. The LGM, Leafy Green Management Association, the Leafy Green Management Organization, it never said that they had to have a scorched earth buffer. It didn't say that they had to have a vegetated buffer, but it didn't say scorched earth. And actually, during the Leafy Green kind of debate of whether or not they would take that whole thing national, there was this exact question. And they said, no, we don't need a scorched earth buffer, to protect food safety. In fact, they said sometimes a scorched earth buffer is counterproductive because now the only food is out in the field. And so they said, look, we need to be reasonable. And I believe that if we need a vegetated buffer for water quality, I think these things can be designed where they don't attract, wild pigs. I truly believe that.
Well, you just said that they wouldn't attract wild pigs, that they could also be such that they don't attract frogs, rodents, birds, and other wildlife that are on the list of no-go.
I don't know. And the reason that I'm answering that is because I do have a bias. I go back to the days in other words, what is food safety? Is food safety protecting against pathogens, or is food safety also include the fact that you're destroying your water? Food safe, and then you have to treat that water at high expense to make it appropriate for other people, other uses. So I guess I look back at the days. First of all, I think that growing food outdoors has risk to human health. In other words, it just, there's worms, there's frogs, there's stuff lives. And what I've seen over the past few years with the food safety debate is that growing in some instances has become a war against nature. And I think back to just a decade ago, maybe a couple of years longer, but a decade ago, when people had hedgerows to attract beneficial insects. People liked having a pond with reeds around it because it was pretty and attracted birds. That wasn't that long ago. And it's turned into a war against nature. And I just think that there's a middle way.
Thank you.
All right, so likewise, I'd like to thank the three of you for your presentation and, you know, in answering the questions that were, you know, suggested to you. The one area that gives me pause a bit is that, as I mentioned yesterday also at the conclusion of the Ag Order presentation, is that we need to be careful not to drift inadvertently, but we are slowly but surely to become prescriptive. You know, when I look at the reference of USDA, basically says, okay, these are the farming practice that you should do. You can do this, you cannot do that, you know. So we are not allowed as a board to be prescriptive. Sure. And so a little bit back to Mr. Young's observation yesterday is relying more heavily on numeric values of, you know, do not exceed this. This is your demarcation avoids us from falling a little bit in the rabbit hole of getting into the weeds, you know, so to speak. So I take your input as, okay, there are solutions available. That's how I take it. You know, it's like, hey, you know, there are certain things that you could do, but I think all of us here and our staff, you know, we need to be recognizant that we do not want to take away also the flexibility, you know, of growers of using some of our practice that they view as being, you know, best available. The other little reflection that I have was on, you know, the quote that you made from a staff member many years ago. I think we have gone a long ways, okay? And I'm the type of person who look at the glasses three-quarter full rather than half full. At least my wife says that I'm an eternal optimist. But there's been progress, and I think we all need to recognize that we have made progress because we do monitor wells. We do require, if you have nitrate exceedance, you know, that has to be reported. We do have a bottled water replacement program. That's a Band-Aid. I'm totally in line with that. That's a short-term fix. We need to work at the long-term fix. You know, we have the UCLA projects, experimental project to, you know, have some small on-site systems. So there's progress. Is it fast enough? Well, probably not. But I don't think we have too, at least with the reporting system we have too many people who get up in the morning. We still probably have some islands of information gap where people perhaps still drink unsafe water. However, I think we have really, really tightened the net on that.
As far as the issue of being too prescriptive, when it comes to management practices and things like the tile drain limits and that, okay, you have 3 years to lower it. You're not prescribing anything at all. You're simply saying, look, here's the goalpost. Kick it over. Same thing with the management practices. You're saying you're required to install some treatment management practices, you know, on the land. And these could be, you know, of a variety of ways. As far as making progress, respectfully, I disagree quite a lot. The reason is first of all, it's part of my science background. Monitoring and reporting in itself changes very little. It's simply monitoring and reporting. And I think that the growers and I actually have something in common. I talk to growers. I offer to talk to many and listen to them that they don't want to talk to me. But I do talk to some growers. And those growers share the vision or a belief that the past orders and the current order are paper shuffles. They're monitoring and reporting. They're paper shuffles, and they actually look at me and they say, and this is as close as I can get it to a quote that I've heard from a couple of growers. I said, I wish I could spend my time and money improving water quality instead of doing all this. And that's why I think that we need to get them more involved. We can't be doing these things for them. We need to get them involved with tests that they can do in their everyday kind of little schedule of, you know, like a to stick a test strip in some water and then to upload it on an app isn't going to take long and isn't going to cost very much. Even the ampules that are more sophisticated, more accurate, and as easy as a test strip cost 99 cents. Literally 99 cents. And that's if you're buying 20. Think if you're buying a bunch. Okay? And I measure success by the regional board's water quality monitoring reports and your statement of water quality conditions. That's how I measure success. And your 2018 water quality report, your statement of conditions, says that it's no different, and in the case of groundwater, getting worse. So I know people encourage me to be the glass, you know, is half full kind of guy. I'm going by the data, and the data says it's getting either not as, or it's getting worse.
But Steve, I was. You know, you took a much broader answer to my glass is three-quarter full. I was specifically referring to the statement pertaining to safe drinking water and the efforts made in the region in recent years to address the human right to safe drinking water. And what I'm suggesting is in that particular area, you know, we're quite a ways from the statement that you quoted. That's all I'm saying. We even have the Declaration of Human Right to Safe Drinking Water. We did pass that. So, and, you know, there's a lot of efforts being made in that area. And our vice chairs, you know, certainly regularly give us update. That was my comment. I think you expanded a little bit on the periphery of it, but I do believe that that's an area where our region has made and continues to make a strong effort. We also hired consultants to help us drill a little bit better in areas that, you know, we didn't have enough data, specifically with the southern part of our region towards Santa Barbara County. So that was the clue to tell me to to stop. And so, again, thank you very, very much. I think this is, again, a good example of being able to have a good, open, frank dialogue. And, you know, I think all of us take this very positively. We have more speakers coming.